Today is going to be on chronic wasting disease and the effects it's having on the captive servant industry. The brief outline for the lecture, start out just giving a background for chronic wasting disease. What's the biology and symptoms behind it, diagnosis and transmission for it, really generalized history of it. What are some control strategies being practiced? Then move into the captive servant industry in general. What are the markets for it out there? What are some of the uses for those products? And then finally look at the impacts that chronic wasting disease is having on these markets, most notably the economic demographic losses, as well as new regulations that are being put into place. Chronic wasting disease is a degenerative neurological condition that belongs to the family of diseases known as the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, or TSEs. Some other members of this group include bovine spongiform, transmissible mink, scrapie in sheep, and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans. Of these diseases, the two that received the most attention recently have been bovine spongiform and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. The reason for this is CJD can be found in humans. In 2002, there were over 100 people that died in Europe, and they think there might be a potential link between them dying of a variant form of Creutzfeldt-Jakob to being exposed to contaminated meat that was infected with BSE. Because CWD is a member of this group, and CJD has been getting so much attention for it, CWD in turn has gotten a whole lot of media attention here in the US recently. Some symptoms that CWD displays in an animal are a general loss of body condition. When an animal is infected, it still eats, but it eats so very poorly and it eats very little, which leads to just kind of a wasting away of the animal, which is where the disease gets its name from. They tend to take on a really wide-based stance. They show excessive drinking and urination, salivation and drooling. They tend to walk repetitive patterns. They grind their teeth a lot, get head, eventually they die. A couple of noticeable things about the death in these animals is that CWD is uniformly fatal. Once an animal becomes infected, it's going to die. Another notable thing about it is because they have difficulty swallowing and they're taking in all these excess fluids and drooling a lot of them die from aspiration pneumonia. Prior to the real exposure and the real attention coming to CWD, a lot of animals that were dying because of this aspiration pneumonia were being diagnosed as dying from pneumonia without being tested for CWD. Now that it's getting all the attention, most of those animals are being tested as well. The incubation period for CWD is one of the factors around it that really isn't that well known. It's estimated that the minimum incubation is about 17 months. It was found in a young animal that was just 17 months old, but it's not known if that animal contracted it shortly after birth or while it was being born. And because most of these studies are fairly new, it's not really known how long it can lay dormant in an animal before showing signs. Clinical signs of CWD alone are not enough to diagnose an animal with CWD. The most common and widely accepted method for this is using immunohistochemical, or IHC, staining. IHC staining takes place in neurological tissue taken from the obex region of the brain. That's the part of the brain that's going to show the earliest signs. If an animal dies, you test from other parts of the brain. It could actually have died from CWD, but it will come back as a negative test. You need to focus on that region. IHC staining is an antibodies-based test. In IHC, they add a stain to the brain tissue so that when it's examined microscopically, presence of antibodies can be seen gathered around abnormal proteins in the animal. Taking a look at the picture, the concentration of the red dye in those circles indicates a CWD-positive animal. Now, this is the most widely accepted and most reliable test, but it also depends on the animal being dead before you can do it. Because of this, there are a lot of new tests being developed, and they're trying to work the kinks out of a lot of them. The two leading tests are looking at lymphoid tissues as well as a tonsillar biopsy. Both of these tests have been found to be fairly accurate in mule deer, but when looking at other species of deer and making that jump to elk, they're a lot less reliable. In one study, using tonsillar biopsies, about 10 to 15% of elk that were actually CWD positive came back as negative. The transmission of the disease, it's another area where there's a lot of new research going on right now, and there's still some unknowns about it. It's believed to spread laterally, both within a species and across species of deer and elk. It's believed the infectious agent is shed through the alimentary tract through fecal material and saliva. And the fact that it's shed through saliva is an important factor when we get to talking about captive cervids. Most notably, because of breeding behavior in males, they're almost twice as likely to become exposed to the disease and infected. Once they're infected, those males are also more sought after within the industry, so they're more likely to be sold and spread around, further spreading the disease. It's not completely known whether maternal transmission can take place or not. Like I said, there was that young animal that was found at just 17 months old, but it's not really known if it had the disease when it was born or if it contracted it shortly thereafter. The infectious agent for CWD is a misfolded protein, or prion. Because of the structure of this protein, it's incredibly resilient in the environment. Again, it's not really known how long it can stay active in the environment, but it's thought it's anywhere from 2 to well over 10 years. So once an area is contaminated with CWD, it's stuck with it for a long time. Another interesting fact about that is once it's in the environment, it can bind to inorganic compounds in the soil. Once it binds to this soil, it actually reduces the incubation period for an infected animal, as well as increasing the potency of it. So once it's there, you've got it for a long time, and you've got a more potent strain of it. How this relates to captive cervids is, one, most cervids are kept in really close proximity to each other, making the spread of it rampant. Some infected herds have seen over 90% infection rates. Different reasons for this are, they're kept in close quarters, contact is inevitable, they're sharing the same environment, they're sharing feed stations, watering stations. Contact is really likely once it's in a herd. And also, because you can't really test for it while they're alive, transportation of these animals causes that disease to spread very quickly. Brief and general history. 1967, it was first officially recognized in Colorado. In the 1970s, it was seen in captive herds in Colorado, Wyoming, and a zoo in Ontario. 1983, hunter harvest surveys were begun. And because of these surveys, in the early 1980s, it was found in free-ranging elk and bull deer. 1990, in whitetails. 1996, it was found in Saskatchewan as well as South Dakota. This turned out to be a pretty major case because infected elk were moved from South Dakota to Saskatchewan. From the herd that they were moved to in Saskatchewan, it was spread to 38 other herds, eventually leading to over 8,000 elk being killed. In 1998, another major event as far as the markets are concerned. Some of those infected elk were shipped from Canada to Korea. And from 2000 to present, it was found in a bunch of other states. We're still finding it today. What that looks like on a map, we've got 14 states that are infected, 2 Canadian provinces. While it looks like a lot, really less than 2% of elk farms have been infected, and less than 1% of all deer farms in the U.S. have been infected. As far as control strategies that are being put in place, the first and most obvious is prevention. If an area doesn't have CWD, managers are doing everything they can to keep it out, including quarantining, banning restrictions on the movement of cervidae, other things of that nature. Once a population is seen to have it, or a captive population is seen to have CWD, those animals are quarantined. They don't come in contact with any other captive herds. Measures are taken to try and reduce contact with wild populations as well. But inevitably, once those animals are positive, they're quarantined, they're going to be depopulated. Three major regions for producers of they are New Zealand, Europe, and North America. In North America, there are about 2,000 elk farms with over 110,000 elk worth about $222 million. Over 5,000 deer farms with over 280,000 animals worth about $111 million. So it's a fairly significant market here in the U.S. Eventually, those animals and/or their products are going to end up in markets mostly concentrated in Southeast Asia, parts of Europe, South Korea, and then North America. The North American market is still fairly new. The real emergence has only been in the past 20 years or so. This is thought because the aging baby boomer population is increasingly seeking natural alternatives to nutritional supplements and medicines. Many uses for keeping cervids, however, the major ones that we're going to look at are their use as breeding stock, being raised for meat, velvet antler production, their use in the hunting industry, and hobby farms for those smaller farmers. Breaking those down, the use is breeding stock. In a healthy market before the CWD epidemic, your healthy average breeding age female would sell from between $2,400 to $9,000, again, based on the age of the animal and market fluctuations. Your average male is starting around $1,500 and going upwards. Another use is the production of velvet antler. Now, this is by far the money maker for the industry. First reason for that is its use in nutritional supplements. Velvet antler is seen to be really high in glucosamine and chondroitin. Claims are made that it can help arthritis sufferers with a little relief. It promotes joint function. In some formulas, especially in the Asian markets, it's said to increase fertility, leading to a type of deer Viagra product. Now, in healthy markets, velvet antler would sell from between $35 to $60 per pound. Again, this was before the CWD outbreak. Your average run-of-the-mill bull elk is going to produce between 18 and 20 pounds of velvet antler a year, or you're going to get a little over $1,000 profit from velvet antler for that animal per year. Your higher-end bulls that you paid, you know, $10,000 and upwards for, they're going to produce 40 pounds or better, leading to well over $2,000 per animal per year. Another use for captive cervids are their use in the hunting industry. Game ranches want those trophy animals. They can charge premium dollar for it. So they go after the biggest bucks, the biggest bulls, buy them, bring them into their ranches, either for direct harvest or to keep them as breeding stock and get their genes through the population so you can hunt their offspring. The price that these hunting ranches pay to the farmers in a healthy market, again, would start at about $2,500 for a bull elk that would score about 300 to 320 on Boone and Crockett. The prices would just go upwards from there. By the time that gets passed on, they start at about $5,000 and climb upwards incrementally depending on the size of the bull. If an animal is not being used in the hunting industry for velvet production or as breeding stock, chances are it's being raised for meat. Again, in an average healthy market before CWD, venison was selling for about $2.50 per pound, hang the carcass weight. In the U.S., this is another really young and emerging market. As an example, in 1992, 1.2 million pounds of commercially raised venison was consumed in the U.S. By 1997, that number had climbed to 3.1 million pounds of commercial venison consumed in the U.S. And that was all prior to the real outbreak of CWD. Some impacts of this epidemic. Most obvious are going to be economic. So going back to our venison production, you used to get about $2.50 average for hanging weight. Now you're looking at about 80 cents per pound, or well below the cost of production. Velvet antler, the real money maker for the industry. The first thing that we saw were exports plummeting. If you remember, some infected elk were shipped from Canada to South Korea. Prior to that event, over 75% of all velvet antler produced in North America was sent to South Korea. As soon as that happened, their markets virtually closed up. In 1998, Canada shipped over $13 million of velvet antler to South Korea. The very next year, that number dropped by over 80% to 2.6 million. That same year, their borders were virtually closed up to the U.S., banning all importation of cervid products. Again, that velvet that used to sell for about $60 a pound as a high average is now selling for about $7 a pound, again, well below production cost. So that bull elk that you paid $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for, you used to get about $2,400 worth of velvet off of it per year. Now you're lucky to get $400. Third impact can be seen in the hunting industry. If you own a hunting ranch in the infected states, one, you're going to see a lot less business coming your way. Two, you're not able to bring in those animals from out of state that you want as the trophies. It's also seen at a statewide level. Using Wisconsin as an example, it's an area that's really highly infected with CWD. In 2002, they estimated that they lost about $68 million because of drop in hunting license sales, as well as drop in hunting product sales. Looking back at the use as breeding stock, your females that used to sell for $2,400 to $9,000 now range about $500 to $1,000. Land values of infected areas have gone down. Again, once it's in the environment, it's there for an incredibly long time. If your herd's depopulated, you cannot restock that land for an unknown amount of time with cervids after that. And finally, looking at overall herd loss. Things that we talked about being put into place inevitably included quarantine and depopulation once your herd is infected. What that looks like on a large scale is in Canada, as of 2003, over 41 herds have been depopulated, with over 8,000 animals being culled. Of those 8,000 animals, only 230 came back as CWD positive. In the U.S., in 2002 alone, 31 farms were depopulated in Colorado and Nebraska, with over 2,500 animals being eradicated. Of those 2,500 animals, only 5 came back as CWD positive. Again, this really seems to underscore the importance of coming up with a live test for the disease. Because of that, a lot of new regulations are being put into place. First, we're seeing regulations at the state level. There are some national regulations being developed. They're not really in place yet, but a lot of states are using them as guidelines to come up with their own. Right now, 23 states have some form of restriction or ban on importing cervids from out of state, and about 20 states have some kind of herd certification program. With that herd certification program, you can go through the steps over a few years to get your herd certified as CWD free. After that, the restrictions are really loosened on where you can buy and sell them on the animals. We're also seeing new regulations on a national level. First, and one of the most major things we're seeing are depopulation indemnities. These animals that are being infected with CWD, these herds that are becoming CWD positive, the government wants to put a wrap on that, really slow the spread of disease as much as they can. So they're providing incentives for the owners of the herds to voluntarily depopulate them. They said that they'll pay up to 95% or up to $3,000 per animal of each animal that needs to be culled and tested for CWD to help slow the spread. They've also developed a herd certification program. Now this is not officially in place yet, but all the guidelines are drawn up. What this entails is a 5-year program where each animal receives two forms of identification. They're completely enclosed in perimeter fencing, and every animal that dies that's over 20 is tested for CWD. After 5 years of going through these regulations, the herd can be certified as CWD free, and those animals can again be sold throughout the interstate system. Now, what this means is that in the short term, herd owners are going to see a very large increase in cost. It's estimated that it'll cost herd owners an additional $1,600 per year just to stick with the program. That's completely separate from any of the initial setup costs. In some areas, exclusionary fencing can cost up to $10,000 per square mile. So over the short term, herd owners are definitely going to see an impact. Over the long term, however, animals that become certified are going to be able to sold throughout the interstate system. And if your herd is not certified, it's estimated those animals will sell for about 50% less than certified animals will. With that, you know, we're looking towards the future. I think we're making a lot of good progress as far as the regulations go. It's probably slowing the disease, but really there's a lot that's unknown about it. I was unable to find any studies that mentioned a quantitative effect as far as the economics go to the industry. Everybody seemed to break it down piece by piece, so nationwide we really don't know what the total impact was. I'd recommend a lot of future research on that topic. And with that, are there any questions? Yes. The question was, how is velvet antler harvested? Deer and elk grow a new set of antlers every year. After about 65 days of growth, the antler's still in the velvet form. They typically cull the animals into some kind of chute, cut the antlers off, and let them go on their way. So it's a renewable resource. They can get at it every year, providing, you know, a profit, albeit a one-time-a-year profit. Yes? The elk in the Smoky Mountains came from Land Between the Lakes, Kentucky, and Elk Island National Park in Alberta. Neither of those areas have seen any incidents of CWD. Joe.
Is it known whether or not captive herds are the ones that infected the wild herds? Has that been shown?
Are you asking if it spread from captive to wild?
Well, I know it spread, but the states where they found it in wild herds, do they get that from captive animals?
Well, it's not. The question was, did it originate in captive herds? And the origin of it is not completely known. Once researchers started monitoring the disease, they knew about it in captive herds, and then in a lot of states, like Colorado, saw it spread from captive to wild populations. But really, because hunter-harvest surveys and wild populations weren't really surveyed for it prior to its existence in captives, we really don't know if it was in wild and spread to captives and then found, or vice versa. Further comment was, if it's being spread to wild populations, it's probably a much larger economic loss than it was in the captive populations. And what's the risk associated? I think everyone would probably agree with that, and that part of the regulations that are being developed include that perimeter fencing, where they make every effort they can to keep contact between captive and wild populations low. I just chose to look at the economic impacts in the captive populations. Yes.
You mentioned that the upper level of the lake isn't really known. So I just wondered how have they dealt with that in setting up their certification process?
The question again is, since the maximum incubation period is not known, how are they handling that as far as regulations go? You know, we really can't determine it because the research is so new. It just hasn't been going on long enough to find out how long can it actually lay dormant. I think the USDA suggested a 5-year wait because a lot of animals that are shown to become infected usually show clinical symptoms within a few months. They know that they can hold it for at least 2 years, so I think they put the 5-year buffer above that, but I'm not entirely sure.
Any questions?